Hello and a warm welcome to the New Wave Heroes podcast. This time it's my pleasure to chat to drummer and guitarist Roy Phillips, who has literally spent a lifetime in music. Roy's story includes playing on hit records and being a popular session musician. And if that wasn't enough, he has played with some of the biggest artists in music history. I started our interview by asking him about his childhood.
And you're a London boy.
Yes, a London lad.
Born into a musical family, I believe, is that right?
Yeah, well, the whole family, not musical. Grandpa, okay. Grandma, not musical. Uncles, not musical. My dad, really. Drummer, a natural born drummer. Started playing as a kid, joined local bands after the war, the Korean War he was in. And, he sort of, the 60s more than anything, that he sort of took it a bit more serious, if you like. You know, he got to join the Joe Loss Orchestra, which were a very big band, actually, at the time, in the 60s, early 60s. They were playing Hammersmith Palais sort of every Sunday night, and they were like the Beatles of Hammersmith, really. And he was in that band for a while, doing stuff, and then he formed his own band called the Day Knights, very 60s name, Day Knights. And I remember as a kid seeing the bass drum, it was half black and half white, and the day was written in white on the black and the nights in white on the black, if you know what I mean. So it was like quite a clever twist. Sure. But there was a great guitarist in that band for a while called Big Jim Sullivan, and he was a very, very well-known local guitarist. I think he did some work with Rod Stewart, actually, the early stuff. But
he was a session guy, wasn't he, back in the day?
Big time. Yeah, so all I remember is my dad having people in the house playing all the time. So as a young kid, obviously you're soaking all this stuff up: bass players, guitarists, keyboard players. My mum actually sang for a bit with the group as well, but all types of stuff, you know.
So is this what got you into music, I'd imagine, when you started on drums originally, yeah?
Yeah, obviously hearing different types of music. My dad was a big rock and roll fan, you know, when Elvis sort of exploded. I was born in 1957, so, I mean, the King was the King then, so that was all going in as a very young kid, you know, and I found it fascinating that I used to watch the records go around and look at the colour of the labels, you know, like Columbia Green and MGM, the yellow label. They were fascinating to me, these labels, you know. I still think of it to this day. And my uncle had a ceiling in them days, you know, they used to have the Artex, which was all circles, and I used to picture pop stars in them. I know it sounds stupid, but I used to picture pop stars in these things. So it was all jumbled up. Because you're a kid, you know, but it was definitely inside. Yeah. And when my dad used to get the kit out, the drum kit in the front room, I used to get on it in between their breaks and just play, you know. But I wasn't frightened of it. I think that was what it was. I sort of knew what to do, although my feet couldn't really reach the pedals at that time. I knew what it was about, sort of thing.
So the drums, do you think that was an instinctive thing for you, or you could just sit there and do it?
Yeah, I used to listen to the drums more than anything on the records, probably. And when I started playing with local boys and stuff, I used to watch where their fingers were on the guitars and stuff. So later on, when I got into guitar, I could play chords without knowing what they were. But drumming, definitely, it's like breathing to me, walking. It's you just sit behind the kit and that's it. It's your domain. It's done.
So did you, the guitar, did you kind of come to that shortly after the drums, or was this much later in your teens kind of thing?
No, this was a lot later, Neil. This was probably 13, 14, I got my first guitar. But as I said, I could play chords, a lot of open chords, not barred chords. I weren't very good at that. But the open chords, I still don't know, believe it or not, to this day, what some of them are called. Because I used to just watch with the shapes of their fingers. And if it's you know what it's like, senses working overtime, XTC. the only sense you really need for music is hearing. You know, you don't need much else, really. If you've got the ears to hear, that's it, I think, you know.
Yeah, I agree. Some people are gifted, aren't they, with perfect pitch and that, which I really admire, you know.
It's one of those, I mean, I don't really think about it that much, but over the years, obviously, people say, oh, you do this, you do that. But really, it's something, you know, it's so natural, if you like. It's difficult to talk about music, really, isn't it? Because there's thousands of books written about music, but none of them really explain really what it is, you know. It's the joy of something, it's the senses.
Yeah, I think it's something you're born with, isn't it? It's in your blood.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
It's like me. It's my dad played, my granddad played. It's just there, isn't it? You know, you're born with it. Yeah. It's probably the right brain, you know, the creative side, I think.
Yeah, I spoke to a guitarist I knew for years, not long ago, actually, and he said, you know what we do, because he's a really great player, this fella, it's memory. He said, I think it's even as much as 90% is memory, because the talent is there anyway. If you've got the talent, that's done. But it's the memory of stuff. If you can recall, it's like a Total Recall, I suppose, you know. I've got a lot of LPs as well, you know, and I can sort of pinpoint certain bits in songs, and you think, "Blimey, I haven't heard that for 30 years." You know, it's just music, really.
Yeah. So, it's your family took you to Australia when you was much younger.
Yeah, we were the 10-pound Poms, as they called us in those days. 1970. Yeah, so that's what we were, really. I was, 12, just coming up for 12 years old, and I had two sisters that are a year younger than me each time, and just thrown into this very strange place, you know, because 1970, you can imagine, it hadn't really changed much for hundreds of years. People going to places, it was the big adventure. Do you know what I mean? The world's so small now, what with this internet and what have you. But yeah, it was hard at first, because they didn't, the Australians, it was still that, you know, they didn't really like Poms, they called us. And it was tough at school, but I found my way, you know, made friends and stuff, but through music, really. I weren't very good at school, you know, never really a sort of academic brain, but had a music class and did well in that, and art. I think all these things are related. Most of the musicians that are famous anyway are from art school, as you know. So that's all linked. That's all linked together, you know. So yeah, I started playing a lot when I was in Australia, really.
Whereabouts did you go in Australia?
Just outside Perth, a place called Morley. It was a new town.
Western Australia, yeah.
Yeah, West Australia. It was a brand new school, actually. Yeah. It was only opened. I was one of the first pupils in the school. And they didn't actually have an art or a music class until I joined, because when they had the first parents' meeting, I think my mum and dad told me years later that the teachers said that your son's got a real gift for musical and artistic stuff, we're going to start this class, basically. So that was enough. And I did write to the school, actually, about 10 years ago to say what I'd done, blah, blah, blah. And they sent me a lovely little emblem thing, you know, as a proud student sort of thing. So it was good, nice. Really. It was great. It was great.
I think that's where Hank Marvin lives now, isn't it, in Perth?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, Hank was he's very important in my musical career, if you like. As I think I told you the other day on the phone, Martin Celia, a guitarist that was at school with me, we were only 12, 13, and he played a red Strat because he was Hank Marvin fanatic. So I went round his house one day and played drums and guitar, and we did loads of shadow stuff, and it was my real introduction to being a proper musician, you know. So I think the Shadows are a very important band anyway. They're that bridge between rock and roll to the Beatles, really, aren't they?
Well, they get overlooked because a lot of people think that pop music started with the Beatles, but that's not true, is it?
Oh, you know? Man. If you look at the skill, they had two fantastic drummers in the Shadows. The first drummer, Tony Meehan, I learnt a lot from the roles that he did. I mean, they were just wild, wild roles. If you put him doing that type of drumming with, say, Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps, or even Little Richard, it would have made that even more exciting. It couldn't have been more exciting, but it probably could have been with him playing. And then when he left with Jet Harris, they did a duo. I think it was Brian Bennett that joined.
That's right.
And he's a fantastic drummer as well. So, yeah, very important band, Shadows. But the look of them as well, they look great, you know.
Yeah, I'm a huge Shadows fan. I was playing some earlier, actually, on my guitar. So, but that's
a fabulous.
Yeah, that's a story for another day.
But there's lots of rhythms, Neil, isn't there? There's lots of rhythms in the Shadows songs, you know, different types of rhythms. It's great for a kid because it's all there, you know, like bossa novas, rock and roll. You know.
I am hoping to have a chat with Bruce, actually. I'm aiming my sights high. I did meet him once before. When Jet Harris passed away, sadly, and there was like a memorial concert that they did in a small rock and roll club in London somewhere.
Yeah.
I went along there and had a brief chat with him, very brief, which was it was just fantastic to sort of say hi, you know.
I'm a big music fan as well. Like, it's funny because I've met quite a lot of musicians, obviously, over my time playing, but it's surprising how many aren't music fans. You know, it's quite a strange thing, really, to be a great musician but you're not a music fan. I still find that strange, but I'm a huge music fan.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of my notes is your record collection. Maybe we'll come on to that later, but you've got quite a few albums, haven't you?
it's quite a lot. it's around sort of 15,000, put it that way.
Vinyl. And these are all at home, are they?
Well, in the loft and downstairs. I change the sort of 1,000 each few months, if you like. But I'm a bit of a geek, I suppose. It's like if you mention an artist, like, I talk to people all the time about music, and they say, "Oh, I love David Bowie," say, for instance, and I start talking to them. Yeah, I've got the best of. And you think, well, I've got 300 albums, you know. So you just told me that you love David Bowie. I don't think you even like him. I'm not being funny.
You haven't even heard him.
You just told me you love him.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, I get a bit like that sometimes. But it's all great. It's all great.
Yeah, you're still a big collector then, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't really see myself as a collector because it's just music that I love. You know, I just pick out an album and put it on. And it could be anything, you know, Jethro Tull or Zappa or anything. Yeah. It's just, it's all consuming. Like, you know, I sort of understand it as well. You sort of feel like you're part of the group. The great music, when you listen to it, especially as a musician, you're actually playing with these people. Do you understand? You know what I mean. You're actually in the group, you know.
So you moved back to England after a few years. Was it just you that came back? Or everybody come back?
No, what did it? My mum came back for a visit to her mum and dad, my grandparents, and that was it, really. We were doing fine over there. We were four years in. Had a house built, swimming pool in the garden. The back garden went into the bush, so there was no fences. That's all I remember because I was quite young still, obviously. But Mum came back, and then obviously she came back to Australia and, I want to go home. And that was it. So we were uprooted again. And so it was basically a bit sort of strange for three kids that were, you know, mid-teens, if you like. You know, it's quite a strange thing to be put in that situation, make up a whole new lot of friends and different things, and then come back to somewhere that was quite alien in a way, you know. because all the people you knew from infant and junior school were gone, you know. But yeah, so music took over even more then, you know. But I must say about Australia very quickly, I did get to play with some really good musicians in Australia, and I was only 16 when I came back, but I'd already played with people that became like Split Enz, I think I mentioned to you, Neil and Tim Finn. I used to go down this record shop in Hay Street Mall in Perth, and there's a little stage, and we used to get up and play, and Neil and Tim used to come in and different bands, and I ended up playing with Split Enz for a bit, and it was great, you know. So yes, we came back, basically.
So when you came back, you're obviously big into your music still, and various bands you was in and out of, but then along came Elvis Costello. Tell me about how all this began.
Right, this was probably late 75. I joined a band, a band called Dry Cane, with a K. I saw a bottle in a pub, Dry Cane, Bacardi gin or something like that. And we were thinking of names, and I said, I'll put a K in front of that, and that's what we were called. So we used to play this pub in Hounslow, the White Bear in Hounslow, and we did it every Sunday lunchtime. And this fella used to get up in between and do his acoustic set under the name D.P. Costello, because his name's Declan Patrick Aloysius McManus, his real name. And D.P. Costello did his bit, and I used to really love these little songs he was doing. They were probably early versions of some of the hits, like, you know. And we started chatting at the bar in between songs, because our band was sort of really progressive rock, you know, Yes, Genesis, King Crimson, all that stuff. I don't think you could, you know, no one could dance to it. It was all in strange time signatures. But there was something about Declan's songs that I liked it, because I come from rock and roll, as I said to you. I'm into Elvis and Little Richard and, you know, Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, that early rock stuff. I'm really into that big time, even now, and that's where it all comes from. And he reminded me of that, because his songs were quite short and they were quite impact. You know, he was quite an impact. His voice, he's not the best singer in the world, but he's got such an, when he was young anyway, great attitude with songs, you know. And we used to talk at the bar, blah blah, and we swapped phone numbers, I think, and I was still living at home, and I didn't see him for a long time. And I came in one day and my mum said, oh, this fella's been ringing all day, do you want to go to Japan? I went, what? Oh, and he like 17 like years old. I went, what? So I rings up, and it was him. He'd been signed up to this new record label, Stiff Records, in Chiswick High Street, and it was Nick Lowe and Jake Rivera and Dave Robinson that owned this little label. And apparently the story goes that he stood outside the office all day just singing these songs, and Nick Lowe came down in the end and said, you're driving us nuts up there, you better come up and sign this contract. And that was it. You know, those type of things happened then, you know, they did.
Yeah.
So they put together this thing, the Live Stiffs Tour, and it was all a lot of bands that they'd signed up, and different artists, Reckless Eric, Ian Dury and the Blockheads, Larry Wallace from the Hawkwind days. So we just did this tour, basically.
So when you came back, was you asked to join the band, or did you just move on again to somebody else?
No, because he did have a band called Flip City. He already had a band that he was doing his solo stuff, but he also had a little combo that he used to do gigs with as well, called Flip City. And I ended up going after the tour. I went to Pathway Studios, which is in Islington, or was in Islington. Very, very famous little studio. If Pathway was in America, it would be a shrine. It would be like Sun Records. But us English being us, you know, I'll get rid of that. Doesn't. But but the amount of bands that started and recorded stuff there, The Damned, all that, they were all in there. You know, Graham Parker in the Rumour, one of my favourite artists of all time is Graham Parker. I think he's probably in my top five greatest singer-songwriters of all time. So I used to see him down there, and I went with Elvis Costello down there, and we did a lot of demo stuff, like Red Shoes and Miracle Man, a lot of stuff that ended up on the first album as well, you know, Waiting for the End of the World, I don't know if you know these tracks. And I did a lot of demos with him, and then he hired a band to do the actual recording of the album, a band called Clover, and they were Huey Lewis's band, actually. They were part of Huey Lewis's news, if you like, you know. So yeah, it was just like when you put all this stuff together, it sounds quite romantic. But I think I said to you before, it's times, you know, it's like a week or a few days or a couple of days, and it's a long time, a long period of time. But still, you know, you do it, and that was it. It was great.
So that was just one name. So I've got loads more on my list. The Clash. Tell me about The Clash.
That was a strange story, you know. I was playing in a pub in, you'll have to forgive me because it gets a bit fuzzy because it's, as I say, it's a long time now. Probably 76, around that time, I was playing in Westbourne Grove, and I think the pub was called the Windsor Castle, but I'm pretty sure. And same band, as I said before, Dry Cane, very sort of progressive. And I noticed these two fellas at the bar, and they had leather jackets on and this spiky hair. It was the beginning of the punk thing, you know. It was this change again, back to basic rock and roll, if you like, you know. They looked like bikers, you know, Teddy Boys. And did our set, came off halfway, went up to the bar to get a drink, and these two fellas are standing either side of me. And I've got to get this vibe, well, what one's going to hit me first, like, you know. And it was Paul Simonon, or I think it's Simonon, you call him, Paul, and Mick Jones. And Paul tapped me on the shoulder and he just said, what are you doing tomorrow, mate? I said, nothing. Get yourself a train over to Pimlico, Vanilla Studios. We're having a jam down there. So I jumped. I spent most of my time on the underground when I was in my teens. I said, well, is there a drum? He said, there's drum kit there, everything. So I went there, and this was a weekend, walked into this place and played all day with this group, which was Paul, Mick Jones, Terry Chimes, who was playing drums, but he also managed the band, but he wasn't a very good drummer, and this fella called Woody Strummer. And Joe, obviously, yeah, yeah. But he called himself Woody Strummer, and his band was called the 101ers. They were a well-known pub band. So I used to see him on the pub circuit, pub rock band. And there was something about him actually then. He had really long hair, and he was doing a lot of grave digging. That was his job, grave digging. But, yeah, it's true. Yeah, Joe, well, Woody, I call him Woody because that's how I met him. And he jumped on the guitar, and this raw, I'd never heard anything like it. It was like he was attacking this microphone. It was like spittle coming out, and we was doing things like White Riot and White Riot. I thought, no, this is exciting, you know, this is great. So I basically just played for a day. Just played, went home, and that was it. Because you've got to put yourself in a position. These people aren't known; they're just blokes you meet in a pub, and you're playing with them. That's it. So that was the story how I met those.
And you
guys.
Never went back again. That was just a one day, was it?
No, I met them. I did a tour with EC in 78. It was the second time he'd been over there. And I bumped into them, and Topper, their drummer, Topper Hedden, another Paul, actually, he was a right heroin addict, basically. He was high on drugs a lot, and he collapsed. And I actually did a few gigs with The Clash over there. So,
wow, what a story.
In the States.
The Damned.
Yeah, that was just before. I didn't really know The Damned that much. I just know that they were signed up, and they're known now for probably, well, it's arguable with the first punk single, really, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
New Rose. But they were on the tour that we went to Japan anyway. But I didn't really mix with them that much. You know, I got on quite well with Dave, the singer. But as I say, I was young. I didn't really think about it that much, you know. But great, great band, great guitarist, sensible, great guitarist.
Yeah, I saw them back in the day in London somewhere. I don't know where it was. Yeah, brilliant, really good. They're still playing now, aren't they?
Yeah. But there was so... Oh, there is a little... There is a little story about The Damned. Sorry, I forgot to see it's all coming back. I was playing in the Greyhound, mm-hmm. Fulham Palace Road. Do you know the you know, in Hammersmith? There's a Fulham Palace Road. There was a massive pub in the 70s called the Greyhound. Everyone played there, Thin Lizzy, a lot of them. Anyway, we were playing there one night, and I think I was 17 or something like that. Came off and there was some girls around us just talking, you know, the usual, the girls around. And this American girl took her fancy to me, I don't know, and we ended up chatting. She said, oh, come back to my place for a coffee. You know, I only live up the road, renting in this flat. So I went back to this flat and it was about 2 or 3 in the morning. I was pretty drunk and all that. This fella came in who was sharing the flat with her, and it was Brian James.
Oh, wow.
And he said he'd just formed this band and it was The Damned. And that's true. He came in. I remember seeing this fellow and he had really skinny jeans on, you know, drainpipe jeans. And it was pretty different for those days, you know, 77. But he looked good. He had this cropped black hair, you know. And yeah, he said, oh, I'm Brian, you know, just forming this new band. And that was The Damned, so... Yeah. Wow, but he's the man that's formed the group anyway.
Yeah. Ian Dury?
Ian was on the same tour. That's what I say, the Live Stiffs, they were just on the same tour. I didn't do any gigs with Ian, but I met him a few times, and his band were... You couldn't categorise the Blockheads at all. They were... Because they were the High Roads, Kilburn and the High Roads before that. And I already had their only album called Handsome. Don't know if you know that album. It's Ian Dury and the High Roads, Kilburn and the High Roads. Mm. But you could hear it already, what he was going to become, you know.
Yeah, their album, New Boots and Panties, that was one of my first albums that I bought, which is absolutely amazing. Very, very good musicians, very good.
Oh, it's a killer. It's a killer album. It's got... a fantastic, you know, rhythm section. He died young, actually, the drummer, didn't he, on that, Charlie? Yeah, very, very tight. And Norman Watt Roy is always now quoted by bass players, isn't he? You know, he's a reference, like, top 5 bass player. I think it's one of those sort of... bit like going into a guitar shop, I suppose, and they say you can't play Stairway to Heaven or Smoke on the Water. can you play Norman Watt Roy bass lines, you know, hit me with your rhythm stick or something?
I think they still play out sometimes, and I think the roadie is the singer now, if I'm correct. So the last one on my list is Sparks. Was this part of the same tour, or was this a different thing?
No, Sparks was a totally different thing. I was... let me get this right now. I was in a studio with a fellow called Robert Stout, Bob Stout. He was a guitarist in another band that I knew, and he knew someone that worked for the BBC. So he said to me, do you want to come to Delane Lee Studios, which is was the BBC's main studio? They want us to do a reworking of Rule Britannia. For a 13-part series that's going to come up called The Best of British. Sure, I'll do anything, you know. It's me, I'll do anything. So it goes down there. And Bob, very good musician, plays piano, So he did all the backing track himself. All I did was play drums, really. So we did a sort of jazzy version of, you know, it was like a jazzy little version, blah, blah. Anyway, halfway through the session, knock on the door. This fellow comes in and says, can I borrow your drummer? And it was, I think it was Russell, my male, that came in. Can I borrow your drummer? Because Dinky Diamond, their drummer, had broken his wrist. So I went in and did a session, which ended up, they were working on Kimono My House. I think it was their first album, actually. And I just did this session. I don't remember that much about it, Neil, to be honest with you. I just went in and they played the track on the piano. I just played along. I think they just wanted to get a rough cut down of some demo stuff. And that's really what it was, just a day, really.
So when was this? This would have been, what, 77-ish?
This was probably a bit later. It could be, 78, something like that. Yeah, it's all around that time, you know. But I met so many. It was Brian Ferry as well. You know, I did a session for Brian Ferry. I did a he did a single, actually, the Everly Brothers' old song, The Price of Love. And I drummed on that for him and got 84 quid for that.
Is that you on the record? Is that you on the record?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, really? £84.
Well,
yeah.
that was just going right for a session drummer, was it?
Well, it was musicians' rates because you had to be in the musicians' union to get the sessions anyway. It was the usual stuff, you know. See, I didn't have any sort of management or anything as well, Neil, don't forget. I was totally freelance. I just went and did my own thing and I'd say, oh, give me this much. I've never been a money orientated person anyway. It doesn't mean anything to me. As long as I've got a roof over my head and I can play, I'm not really bothered, you know.
You're a prolific songwriter, aren't you? You sent me a list. Yeah, there's so many. It's incredible.
Oh, songs, yes. It's probably getting on, in realistic terms, it's probably over 300 songs now that I've written. But I did start writing probably the same time I was working with Costello and that, because he's such a prolific songwriter. I mean, talk about prolific, it's ridiculous. He used to sit opposite, because the great thing about him, he would play everything on acoustic guitar. So every thing that we know and love about the songs, you know, the rhythms, Pump It Up, Oliver's Army, the big hits, you know, Can't Stand Up for Falling Down, whatever. Mind you, he's done 69 singles. A lot of people don't realise this. 69 singles now. But, so yeah, it was left up to you to bring your thing to it. He was the first to say if he didn't like it, obviously, but it was very open. But yeah, so songwriting, I got a lot of stuff from that, but my biggest songwriting influence is Bob Dylan. There's no getting away from it. I was a huge, and still am, a huge Dylan fan. To me, it's a different place, you know. It's so many different types of things, from the 1961 Dylan to the 80s Dylan. It's like 50 different people that are writing songs, you know, of all types of songs. So I use that as a reference and a building block from everything, I think.
Yeah, I listened to quite a few of the stuff you sent me, and there's, you know, I could hear Dr. Feelgood, I could hear Johnny Cash, I could hear all sorts in there, you know. There was a bit of everything. Yeah. Buddy Holly, which is all good. It's all good stuff.
Yeah. Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, Buddy is another big one. To me, Buddy Holly's the first garage punk musician, I think. If you strip it all back, you've got all these people who have been done before. If you take it back and back, I mean, I find myself going backwards rather than forwards. I'm at Hank Williams at the moment a lot, you know, which is the 40s, really, you know. But it's the power of song. He's like to me, Hank Williams is the hillbilly Shakespeare.
That's a good phrase there. I like that.
That's my description of Hank. Yeah, Hank is the hillbilly Shakespeare. That's my view.
Yeah, I grew up on country music. So my dad played in country bands, so, you know, I'm a big fan.
Great. No, it is great. I mean, it's changed a lot over the years. I must admit, I'm a bit of a purist with country. I don't like strings that much put on it. You know, Billy Sherrill, mm-hmm. the producer, is responsible for bringing a lot of strings into country music. I think because he was married to Tammy Wynette at the time as well, you know. And, because Elvis Costello did an album over there, you know, in Nashville called Almost Blue. And he didn't get on at all with Billy. I remember him coming back, and because my best friend, a fella called Tony Burgoyne, it was Elvis Costello's first brother-in-law. So Elvis married Mary Burgoyne, one of Tony's sisters, just before he got signed up to Stiff Records, actually. He's been married 3 times now, as you know. But yeah, me and Tony, he's still in touch every day. We go way back before Elvis got signed up, you know, and had some great times actually with Declan as well, playing in his front room in Chiswick. He lived in Chiswick with Mary, and he'd already done 2 albums by then. I think this year's Model had just come out, and I remember going round the house with Tony and setting up in the front room and just playing, and Elvis would come in and say, well, what's going on here? And he'd jam with us and stuff. And it was great. You know, great days.
So this come up to date now, and your new project, or your most recent project, Strange Rain. Tell me about that.
Yeah, Strange Rain. That's, it's just basically it's me doing everything with a fella I met who's singing most of the lead vocals. His name's Lee Sperling. And I went into a record shop in Chertsey. Must be 20 years ago now. Must be. And I went into this little record shop. It's gone now, obviously, like all great things go. And I was just going through the records. It was a tiny little shed place, but it was packed to the gills with records. You know, it's like a dream come true. You couldn't believe how many records are in this place, you know, thousands. And this fella's sitting behind a little makeshift counter, and I'm going through stuff, and I went up to the counter. I remember it to this day, and I said, oh, have you got any Hank Williams like records? And he said, oh, we got a little country music section over there. Went through that. Went back and said, have you got any Led Zeppelin? And before I walked away, he said, you're a musician. You're a drummer. I went, yeah, and so are you. It was like one of those strange things. And he'd been drumming for like 12, 15 years, had his own band called Weaver. And they did quite a lot of supports in the early days with Paul Weller, because the guitarist in Weaver, Mark Weller, Paul's cousin. So there was that sort of connection as well. And Paul, I used to see quite a lot as well when I was playing with Costello at the Red Cow in Hammersmith. It was a lot of pubs in Hammersmith in the 70s you could play. You could go and see the Jam, you know, for nothing, basically, just walk in and these bands were playing. So, yeah, that was our little connection. And then we swapped phone numbers. He came round my house, as I say, almost 20 years ago now. I won't bore you with it. We sat down. We must have written 8 songs in that first one night. And they were good songs. You know, me on guitar, acoustic. Lee has got this terrific brain for lyrics, but nothing written down. You know, this is the strange thing. Just comes out. And we would say to each other straight away, basically, oh, let's do something Wilson Pickett meets Led Zeppelin via whatever, you know, Captain Beefheart. And I would know what he means. It's sort of that sort of relationship, you know. So that's how that came about.
And you write for a magazine now, I believe, Psychedelic Baby. Yeah, that's a cool name.
Yeah, well, I don't really write for them. I sort of... Yeah, it's a great magazine. You should check them out. It's Psychedelic Baby. It's a really good website. I don't think he does a physical magazine. It's online stuff. But he has some great interviews, and I've ended up doing some interviews alongside him as well, because I recommend people that I've met in the past, obviously. The last one was Clive Gregson. I don't know if you know the band Any Trouble, which was signed to Stiff Records, believe it or not. They were signed in 1980, and I met Clive way before that. Another incredible singer-songwriter you've got to listen to. I'm telling you now, Any Trouble. His solo stuff is a totally different kettle of fish, but the two or three albums with Stiff under the name Any Trouble, check it out. So, yeah, I got in touch with Clive, and we did this interview, and I'm doing that as well. So I've done about five now, different interviews. And
is this sort of a monthly thing that you're doing now?
No, as I say, I've only done about five.
Yeah, just sort of ad hoc, yeah.
It could be, but I don't. I get in touch with Clement when I find something of interest, or I think maybe of interest to him more, you know. So, but he's into his music big time, you know. But yeah, so it's a good way of finding new good music as well, you know, because as you know, there's so much bubblegum rubbish just thrown everywhere, you know, willy nilly. But there are good things out there, you know, still.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. If you dig deep, it's there, isn't it? But you just tend not to hear it. The top 40 radio is, yeah, you know, it's dreadful.
Yeah, the industry's gone, and what I know about the music industry doesn't exist at all now.
Because you can't make any money from music these days, can you? It's all about the touring and the merchandise.
Yeah, no. Well, as I say, I never did make... Well, I did make money, but I didn't really think about the money side of it. It was more about just being a music man and doing everything you can, the best you can, every time you play. You know, every time I even now sit behind a drum kit, well, here we go. The same old, it's nothing like that. Mm. It's still as though I'm 10 years old. But the only difference is when you get older, you do get a little bit scared about doing those fills. But when you're young, it's all abandoned, isn't it? It doesn't matter, you know. But when you get a bit older, you think, oh, shall I do this? Yeah. But yeah, it's still the same. Still the same.
So do you still play out live?
Not live. I jam probably twice a week with different people I've known over the years. I'm actually, through your wonderful website, yeah. It is a wonderful website as well, because I stumbled upon that. A fella I've been in touch with on the website, I'm meeting on Friday this week. And we're having
a good advert. Thank you.
Yes, and his name, can I say his name? Is that okay? Fossil Fuel,
yeah, sure.
Which were, or maybe still be going, not sure, an XTC tribute band. And XTC are my second favourite band of all time. That's it. Hands down. Beatles, XTC, I'm done. And I couldn't believe it. And he was the guitarist in this XTC tribute band. I've spoken to him on the phone yesterday. Yeah. And we're meeting on Friday for a jam with another
fella. I'm really happy about that. I'm really happy about that. Thanks.
Yeah,
for that.
I am as well. Yeah.
Really good news. So I've been working on that project for a while, and it's only been live probably, I don't know, 2 months probably, not very long. And it's getting a lot of interest, though.
I think it's a great idea, Neil. It's been quite frustrating for us older fellas, you know, because you go on things like Join My Band or whatever it is, Band Mix, and you swap a couple of emails and you think, God, what is the point of this? You know, it's a different language. It might as well be a totally different language or another planet or something, you know. You mention a name like Zappa or something and they say, what's that mean? Is that a Batman saying or something? Zappa. You know what I mean? It's like, it's difficult. It gets...
Exactly. For the benefit of the listeners, we're talking about my website called matuhaband.com, where you can join and meet other, let's say, mature musicians who have been around the block once or twice, maybe. And obviously, it's working. So that's really good news, Roy. Thank you.
No, I wish you all the best with it, Neil, because it is a great idea, I think, anyway.
Yeah, so I'm going to put you on the spot now. The final question, because we're probably coming to the end now. If I book a table for four in a restaurant, there's you, three other people, alive or dead, who would you choose?
Oh, blimey. Well, there's one comes to mind that it's a totally different story to music, but it's all relevant to me, what makes me. And that's James Dean, the actor that died at 24 years old in 1955. He's number one. He's sitting next to me. Elvis, probably Presley. I don't mean that other fella. Elvis. that other fella. Sorry, Declan. That was a strange story as well. Why I'd have called him Elvis, I don't know. But he's got past that really well, hasn't he? You know, I mean, calling yourself Elvis, what? No, great. Hats off to him. So, yeah, James Dean, Elvis, and, oh, blimey, maybe Bill Bruford, probably. It's my favourite drummer. If I had to pick a drummer, I like so many, but Bill's quite special for me.
So James Dean, he died very young. He died before Elvis. This is the Elvis.
Yeah.
Did much at all, didn't he? He was actually dead before Elvis, which is incredible.
Jimmy, I'll have to send you a link, and maybe you could use my link for some... I'm going to advertise myself a little bit here. It must be 4, 5, 6 years ago. I can't remember. Brain's useless. But a few years ago, I went onto the James Dean official website. I went over to James Dean's old farmhouse in Indiana in 1983. And I was the same age he was when he died when I went there. Got that so far? Mm-hmm. I was... never more than 8.5 stone. I was skinny, little sod. Pack of Chesterfields up the sleeve, red jacket over the shoulder, blah, blah. Wanted to see the grave of James Dean. So I found this farmhouse because he grew up on a farm in Indiana, 425 acres of nothingness. And he's actually buried in the farmhouse grounds. Anyway, I found myself there. It's all in this story. And, I went on the James Dean website and told them this little story, and I had about 1,000 emails the next day, and one was from a film director in France, and he said, are you telling me that you stayed in the farmhouse where James Dean lived and grew up? I not only stayed there, I was there for 2 weeks, and I slept in his bed, and I was in his bedroom, which was still exactly the same. This is all true, Neil. Anyway, the strangest story ever. You'll have to read this story because it's too long to tell you. But, yeah, so when I turned up at this grave, there was nothing there. The taxi driver dropped me off in this graveyard. I didn't even notice the tombstone wasn't there. It was just a pile of dirt. He'd gone. And he said, when do you want me to pick you up? I said, well, couple of hours maybe. I was just going to sit there because I was obsessed with James Dean. You know, dawned on me, there's just a pile of dirt. It's not even a stone, because it was all in books. I'd seen books. It wasn't internet or phones then. You know, it was just like this police car turns, I won't bore you with the story, but this police car turns up behind me. Deputy Sheriff Ferguson gets out with a big gun and all that. I'd never seen guns on me. We're going to frighten the life out of me. He was investigating the stolen tombstone. It had been stolen twice in the time that James Dean had been buried. Anyway, I was kneeling at the grave, and this is no, I'm just kneeling at the grave like this. And he came up behind me and he said, I damn near think I'd seen a ghost. And he was talking about me, because I had the red jacket over my shoulder and the fact. Yeah. Anyway, we start talking, blah, blah, and then this other couple turn up, and their name was Joan and Wilbur Hoskins. It's all ingrained in my brain, see. And they owned a shoe shop in Jonesboro, which was the next town to Fairmount, where Jimmy Dean was born. And they used to babysit James Dean as a kid. This is the strangest story in the world.
Wow.
People go to this grave every year, and I never saw anyone, and these people turned up. He said to me, have you been to the old farmhouse? I said, no. They took me down the farmhouse, knocked on the door. Marcus Winslow opens the door, beard. This is James Dean's cousin, only living relative. He's in his 40s. I've got photos of Jimmy Dean, Marcus is 8 years old. who's this guy? He said, oh, this is Roy. He's come like a million miles to see Jimmy's grave. He looked me up and down. He said, you better come in. 2 weeks later, I'm still in there. But it goes on and on. Read the story. I'll send you a link. So that's that.
Yes, I'd love to read that. You said, I'm assuming you haven't written a book, but you should write a book.
I did start writing some stuff down.
Did you keep any diaries or anything?
No, it's all in my brain. But I did start writing. I wrote a few pages. I was going to call it A Hard Day's Write, but someone already nicked the name. Someone's written a book about Beatles songs and called it Hard Day's Write. I was a bit annoyed about that.
So you're retired now, I assume?
Finished now, Neil, yes, all done. I had a big heart attack, actually, 2 years ago. Yeah, big one, quadruple bypass. So I'm back out playing now, but 2 years ago, no, it was a big shock, you know, just totally out of the blue, blah, blah. Had to zip me up, you know, I got the zip, the famous zip now on the front. Took the veins out of my arms and legs, and they're all in there. Still playing, I'm back, and I'm still the same. So, but it changed a lot.
When you play, I'd imagine it does. So when do you play now, do you play drums or guitar? What's your instrument of choice?
It's funny because I love to play guitar more now because it's easier to pick a guitar. You know what drums are like. You've got 15 cases and they weigh a ton because I'm not allowed really to lift anything over 10 kg, apparently. But guitar amps weigh a lot more than that, as you know. But I do prefer to play guitar these days. I feel more comfortable with it. But everyone that rings me, we need a drummer. Oh, Roy, can you come and drum? Usual. That's what I do, really. I'm a drummer, you know, but I do love playing guitar more.
Okay, we'll probably wrap it up there, Roy, so I've taken an hour of your time this evening.
No, that's fine, Neil. It's been a pleasure.
I'm very grateful for that. It's been fascinating listening to your stories. So it's all a long time ago now, isn't it? 50 years, some of that stuff. It's crazy.
Sometimes I lay in bed, you know, Neil, and I think, what's that? Who was that fella that was doing that? You can't connect yourself sometimes with it, you know, especially like in Australia. Sort of these flashes of Neil Finney standing next to you as a 17, 18-year-old lad. And you're 13 and you're drumming with this fella that's an incredible singer-songwriter, you know. But, yeah, great times.
Some of those photos I saw briefly, they were amazing of you when you was, like, probably in your late teens, I'd imagine. They're really cool.
Oh, yeah. There was a couple of newspaper clippings.
With the Rickenbacker. Oh, that's a great photo.
Yeah, the Ricky. I've still got the Ricky, yeah. So that was actually given to me by my youngest sister. She became administrator for Roland UK, and she got me that as a birthday present. I think that was 1980 because I remember Lennon died in 1980, as we all know. She got me that because I'm a huge Beatles fan, as I mentioned to you. So that's the closest I could get to the Lennon guitar, you know.
Let me know how you get on with this guy as well later in the week.
Yeah, I will do. Yeah, definitely. We were talking about. he texted me early and he said, is there any particular songs you would like to play? And I thought, I can't say XCC, he's probably sick of it. Because I think they've done about 55 gigs, which is three times more than XCC did live anyway. So.
Thanks very much, Roy. I really appreciate it. It's been fascinating listening to you.
You're welcome, Neil. And let's hook up again sometime. Be great.
So that brings us to the end of this episode. My thanks again to Roy for sparing the time for this interview and sharing those amazing memories. I will include links in the episode notes to Roy's YouTube channel, his full James Dean feature, and the Psychedelic Baby magazine he writes for. Thanks for listening, and I will catch you next time on the New Wave Heroes podcast, or you can listen to the New Wave Heroes radio show by clicking the link on this website. See you next time. Bye for now.